week of October 2nd, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 338, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, considering getting a law degree, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why a law degree in Allentown? Or
well,
does it not have?
I'm in Allentown thinking of a law degree. I would get a law degree anywhere, probably Harvard, I guess. But I felt very proud of us. You know, last week we talked about the IMDb ruling, you know, the California law saying IMDb will not be allowed to post ages of actors. And we were like, that just doesn't sound constitutional. And then a few days later, we had a story in the Hollywood Reporter saying, that just doesn't sound constitutional.
Right.
Pretty much everyone says, that ain't flying. There's no way that's going to fly.
Yeah. So basically you're saying that a service, well, you basically, yeah, no, it's not going to fly.
We're not lawyers, but we play one on a podcast and it works.
Yeah. And you know what? If it's public knowledge already, you can't have IMDb, which publishes public knowledge, take it down.
Right. Of course. So, well, there we go. But I mean, it hasn't been ruled yet, but I'm sure it'll go to the courts and they will lose. So this is the show you go to find out, you know, constitutional interpretations. But what else will we talk about on this week's episode?
I can't believe you were able to say the word constitutional what that last words you said, interpretations of the Constitution. That's a tongue twister.
Well, me words good.
Okay. Well, on this week's show, to answer your question, Michael, we're going to discuss something that didn't happen, really. Namely, the FCC vote on cable company set-top boxes. We've been talking about it for a while, and it was supposed to be ruled on September 29th, and nothing happened. During our book filter segment, Michael will head to the Victorian era to strongly recommend a book he hasn't even read yet. So we're basically discussing a lot of things that didn't happen and why they're important. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss something that maybe will be happening, namely the merger of CBS and Viacom, and why such a bad idea is gaining so much momentum. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll debate the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, and we also look at LA Times, New York Times, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Box Office Profit, and Mojo, the numbers, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, Tim Burton, is feeling brighter, I guess. Normally, he's pretty gloomy and dark, but today he must be happy because the number one movie is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, $65 million on its opening weekend, and a return to form for Tim Burton, who hasn't had a hit like this since Alice in Wonderland, I'd say, back in 2010.
Well, and you know, arguably in 2010, a lot of the revenue, or a good portion of the revenue, I should say, came from 3D when 3D
made $1 billion.
Yeah. Yes. And like close to at least 30 to 40% of that came from people curious about 3D. That's not to say it wouldn't have made a lot of money to begin with. You know, it's interesting. I was with a bunch of studio executives over the weekend when the Friday night numbers came in early in the morning. So it was like, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. Which I guess isn't so early, but they were all saying, look at, you know, Miss Peregrine is going to get a complete buy, a complete pass, and Deepwater Horizon, which came in second and made $20 million, is less of a disaster because it'll probably make, well, we'll get to that in a second, but you know, they're saying this movie cost $110 million, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar right. Children. It costs more like $150. And
well, what do you mean? How do they know? Do they work on it?
We
always have asterisks by the box office, you know, numbers we're given, because it's either, you know, trying to make an argument from the studio, or it's some third party claiming they think they know what it cost, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, so there's always, we don't really have the numbers.
Yeah.
We have no access to no numbers. It's all sort of a guessing game. But yeah, it says $110 million. There's certainly no stars, big stars in the movie as far as that. So Tim Burton is the big player as far as salary and, you know, cut of the gross.
Right. And so they're looking at this going, okay, so it made $30 million on its way to like 90, maybe $100 million for Miss Peregrine. I think it's going to do better. But they said the minimum break even for that is going to be about 120. So that's a bigger problem.
They mean in North America.
In North America.
Because that they think that will say what it makes overseas. Well, what matters is the worldwide gross. It started with $65 million. If it makes $400 million, they'll be doing great, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Deepwater Horizon, however, well, I'll let you keep going.
Okay, that was very confusing. So they said it costs more than they said, and they think it's not going to make much money.
Right, and that people...
It's not a great start. I mean, it's disappointing. Everybody said the North American box office was not great.
Right, so, basically they're looking at it as it's getting a pass, at least...
who's giving it a pass?
The press, giving it a pass because, you know, it came in first.
Well, yeah, that's stupid. We don't do that.
Yes, we don't. You're right.
That's right. That's why people turn into our show.
That's right.
But it is his first big hit since Alice in Wonderland, which made its bones with 3D and the excitement of that. What's the word on the 3D breakdown for this movie? Not a peep.
Yeah.
No idea.
They stopped.
They don't
really
want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that tells you something. And number two around the world is a movie they do want to talk about. It's called I Belonged to You. It's a Chinese romantic comedy about two radio DJs in love. I bet they got the rights to the soundtrack as well. It grossed $33 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on a Monday or Tuesday or something, or Wednesday, because its total is $44 million. So about, I should say, $45 million, $44.9 million. So great, strong opening week for I Belong to You in China. And number three is Deepwater Horizon, the disaster flick, I guess, starring Mark Wahlberg. $33 million on its opening weekend. We have the budget being the same as Miss Peregrine. Miss Peregrine cost $110 million, we say. That's what some people are reporting. The same is being said for Deepwater Horizon. It opened up in 53 territories, actually, just about the same. It's a lot of overseas territories, more than I would expect, actually. So in North America, it made $20 million, and overseas, about $12
million. Right, and so they're looking at this as kind of a disappointment.
Yeah, again, it matters where it ends up. Will there be legs for it? It's more of an adult film, I think.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
It is a disaster flick. It's a spectacle, but I think it's more like Sully than it is like Miss Peregrine.
Yes, absolutely.
And number four is The Magnificent Seven, another $30 million for the Western reboot, $108 million worldwide.
It's not really a reboot of the Western genre. It's more a remake of a film that had been remade previously.
That's right.
Yeah.
And nobody I saw it has liked it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. They're all like, you know, they're like, yeah.
It looks good. You know, Antoine Fuqua stuff.
It was all right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And number five, here's an interesting movie. It's Lord, Legend of Ravaging Dynasties. This is an animated fantasy adventure flick. It's from China, and it's written and directed by Jingming Guo. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that name. I apologize. I tried to look it up, but couldn't figure it out.
Wouldn't it be Guo?
Well, I'm sure you're right.
Okay.
He's a 33-year-old enfant terrible of China. He's an author, a teen pop star, a pop cultural force, and he's even nicknamed Super Plagiarism Boy because his second novel was accused or actually found guilty of plagiarism. But he is a force of nature, and he's a big player, and he has written and directed this movie, and it grossed $30 million on its opening weekend. At number six is Storks, another animated flick. $28 million over the weekend, $77 million worldwide.
You know, you called him an enfant terrible, right?
Yes, I should have the Mandarin equivalent of that, obviously.
Let me do you the favor of saying...
顽童.
There you go.
So, sorry, what was that?
I don't know.
did you pronounce it correctly?
顽童. That wasn't me pronouncing it.
What was that, the Mandarin pronunciation of that phrase?
Yes, enfant terrible.
Okay, there you go. And number seven, is that your avatar? Is that your, like, the computer robot? Is that your Westworld robot?
Exactly.
All right. And number seven is Operation Mekong. This is a Chinese Hong Kong crime drama, and it's based on the real incident of fishermen who were slaughtered by drug lords, reportedly working with rogue soldiers from Thailand. So Thailand is going to ban this movie. They're very angry about it. $23 million on its opening weekend, so a strong opening for that movie. And number eight is Bridget Jones's Baby. This is a hit. $21 million over the weekend, $120 million worldwide. And they say the budget is $35 million. It's three big stars in it. You know, Patrick Dempsey, Colin Firth, and of course, Renee Zellweger. But they say the budget was $35 million.
You know what? Let's say they're wrong. Okay. Let's say they're so wrong that it's $70 million. Okay.
Okay.
And that they spent $50 million marketing the thing. Okay. Which would be a lot, right? So that
They wouldn't spend 50 on worldwide, do you think? Yeah.
Yeah, worldwide. So okay. So I'm overestimating everything here, okay? That means that they would have spent $120 million to get this thing into theaters around the world, this Bridget Jones's Baby.
Right.
It's made $120 million already. So it's broken.
And it's chugging along, and they hope to, if the cost of the budget was $70 million, we always assume that there is a marketing budget. So if it costs $70 million to make, they'd want to make around $210 million. It looks like they might get there. It says good legs. It's still making $20 million a week. So, you know, they know that if they get to that level at the box office, they're going to reap a certain amount of money on DVD and cable and pay TV and video on demand and all that, and they will be just fine.
That is correct. And think
that's
about
what we mean by a hit, isn't it?
Yes. And think about it. Yeah. Well, you already said pay TV. Yeah. So you've done all the ancillary stuff too. So yes.
Yeah. It's not that we're saying it's free and clear right off the bat, but we're saying it will be free and clear. And there's a very strong probability that this baby is going to make everybody money.
Yes. No pun intended. Although I will tell you that if you are the accountant at Universal who has to tell Renee Zellweger that she's not getting any royalties, then no, it's deeply in the red.
Well, she can't expect any. If she has some net points to make her feel good, I would just say you can keep your net points, but surely she's not waiting for a royalty check. She's waiting for an upfront check because that's where she makes her money.
No, I'm talking about for when it it airs on cable and television and, you know, DVD. Well, not DVDs, but certainly the broadcast. There are certain fees you get just because your likeness is portrayed. You get certain amounts.
Oh, like when a commercial runs.
Right, exactly. So you get, those checks will definitely come, but certainly, as you say, there will never be a royalty check from sales of this movie.
But she's not waiting for it. Even if it made no. $500 million, she wouldn't be expecting that, right?
If it made $500 million, they'd have a hard time. They'd give her a bonus and, that would be...
Right. Yeah. Say, here, have a car.
Right. Well, it's more like, okay, here's $150,000. Here you go. Because it hit a certain number.
$150,000? I don't think so.
Oh,
try a couple million. They're not going to, here's $150,000.
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking more along the lines of what writers make. Like,
yes,
when,
you are.
Yeah, yeah. When it hits like $100 million, the writer always picks up the phone, calls their, hey, we, it made $100 million in North America. I get my bonus. And it's usually, between $50,000 and $150,000.
Right. And number nine is MS Dhoni, The Untold Story. This is a Bollywood biographical pic about the captain, the current captain of the national cricket team. It grossed $15 million on its opening weekend. That's exactly what they say it costs to make. So that's a great start. And it opened on 250 screens in North America.
I was just going to say, look at the $1.2 million there.
That's right. And that's it ranked number 13th for the week in North America. So it almost broke into the top 10. So that's very cool. Very exciting to see more and more Bollywood movies and Korean movies opening practically day and date here in the U.S. because they've got the groups here and it should appeal to wider audiences.
And of course, the technology allows them to do that.
Yeah. And number 10 is Mission Milano. This is a Chinese action comedy starring Andy Lau, $15 million on its opening weekend. Chugging along just nicely is Sully, the Clint Eastwood Tom Hanks flick, another $50 million on the weekend, $150 million worldwide. At number 12, this is exciting for me, Finding Dory opened in Germany and Austria. It made $13 million on the weekend. It's now at $985 million, which means it will definitely, in a week or two at the most, cross the $1 billion mark.
And so I can see the Variety and Hollywood Reporter headlines already.
That's right. And it means, as a writer, I can call them up and say, hey, cross the $1 billion mark. Don't I get a bonus?
Well, yeah, you probably get quite the bonus for that one.
That's
yeah.
Right. So, yeah, so this is the third movie from Disney this year to cross the $1 billion mark. Captain America, Zootopia, and Finding Dory. And way down at, is it still on the charts? I looked it up.
Star
no, it's
Wars.
Not on the charts. It's The Jungle Book. I think it's opened up pretty much everywhere. I don't see any remaining territories of any note that would put it over the top. So I think that's stalled at like $965 million. So unfortunately, even if they re-released Jungle Book, I don't think it would. They might do it during the Oscar campaign or something, but I don't think they're going to get people to come back out to that movie. Pretty much everyone saw it that wanted to.
Although you know what they are re-releasing?
What?
Is all the Harry Potter movies on IMAX.
Yes. Why are they doing that?
Well, because of...
Just to make money, obviously. Well, but is there some anniversary or some
No,
excuse?
they're doing it in the run-up to Fantastic Beasts.
Fantastic Beasts.
Yes.
I wondered why I saw that. That makes sense.
And not all of the films were released in IMAX originally. So they're having to...
That doesn't stop them these days. They don't care. They show lots of movies on an IMAX screen that weren't shot in IMAX. Most aren't.
Right, correct.
Yeah. Though I do want to see the Terrence Malick film in IMAX, which opens up, I believe, this weekend.
Oh, this is the Brad Pitt film.
Brad Pitt narrates the 40-minute version, and somebody else narrates the 90-minute version.
Okay.
So there are multiple narrators. What's the name of this film? It's Terrence Malick's crazy Birth of the Universe movie.
Yes, that's right. Which some would call the first 20 minutes of Tree of Life or something. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so that's that I think is opening up on IMAX this week. And that's the first movie in a while that I've actually wanted to see in IMAX.
It's called Voyage of Time, the IMAX Experience.
And the other one is the longer version. I forget who the... Is it
Voyage of Time, Life's Journey.
And that's narrated by Cate Blanchett?
Oh, yeah, I would imagine that sounds about... Yeah, Cate Blanchett.
There we go. And number 13 is Azura, The City of Madness. This is a Korean crime thriller, though Azura, as far as I can tell, are Hindu deities. I'm not sure why it's called Azura, The City of Madness, but it made $9 million on its opening weekend. And at number 14, kind of a flop here in North America, it's Masterminds. This is a heist comedy co-written and directed by Jared Hess of Napoleon Dynamite, a movie that kids under 30 think is genius. This movie, we don't know the budget on it. It sat on the shelf for several years. It stars Zach Galifianakis. It got terrible reviews, and it opened to a very modest $8 million.
You know, I saw a Korean film recently that is worth looking up. It's The Age of Shadows.
Oh, did you see that period flick? That's been on the charts, of course.
Yes, and that's kind of why I mentioned it, because I'm surprised it's not on the charts still. It's Ji-Woon Kim, who directed, what was the other film he directed that, I want to say The Good, The Bad, The Ugly, The Weird.
The Good, The Bad, and The Weird, yes. Yeah. The spaghetti western homage.
Yes, and it's made, I guess, in North America, it's made $376,000, but certainly overseas, it's doing much, much better.
And it's an Oscar hopeful for Korea, correct?
Yes, it's Korea's entry to the end. And it's worth seeing.
And was it good?
Yeah, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, so it's a little long, but it's one of those like cloak and dagger stories.
It's only long if it's not good.
Yes, that's true, actually. It's a cloak and dagger story set in the 1920s during the Japanese occupation of Korea. And it's, you never know who's actually the double crosser. It's, you know, people double crossing other people who are double crossing other people. It's fun.
Do you think it will get an Oscar nomination? Is it a one that might appeal to the Foreign Academy Oscar voters?
It might. It's a little hard. You know what? It's a little hard to keep track of all of the characters because, at least for me, they're speaking a foreign language and they're wearing disguises. And then so you're like, was he the guy that did the...
Does it feel like an Oscar nominee for best foreign film?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. But a movie that you think is fun and worth seeing.
Definitely worth seeing.
I wonder how it got the pick. He doesn't seem to be a director that makes Oscar hopeful type movies. Though this is a period piece, it's perhaps more sane than some of his other films. I really kind of enjoyed the Good, the Bad, and the Weird. But the politics of how movies get picked country to country, you could write a book about it.
Yeah, and frankly, you know, who knows what else is nominated submitted
this year.
Well,
Korea has so many big movies. I would think they'd have lots of good choices.
Right. This particular film, though, I'll tell you, is so competently directed. I mean, it's like a throwback as to how well this movie is directed.
It just feels like an old Hollywood studio flick.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, there you go. Maybe that's the appeal. And at number 15, let's wind it up here, is The Secret Life of Pets. This isn't an immodest gross at all. $7 million over the weekend, $833 million worldwide. That is a lot of money for a movie that seems sort of a modest bet.
Yeah, I would say.
I mean,
yeah.
It's made more than Deadpool. You know,
good point.
That's pretty great. That's way up there. I mean, as far as the big movies of the year, it's only behind Jungle Book and Batman versus Superman, and it may pass that any minute now.
And you were going to say it's only behind, well, actually, every single Disney movie that made $1 billion.
Well, yeah, Captain America. We already mentioned those. Yeah, Captain America and Zootopia and Finding Dory.
Yeah, but I mean, let's face it, Secret Life of Pets is one of those movies that's going to make a mint on DVD and on Netflix and, you know, well, maybe not Netflix because, you know, it's a SVOD, so you can watch it 100 times and not have to pay for it each time, but any kind of transactional VOD, it will certainly do well on.
Oh, absolutely. It's a family film. It's animated. It will do well. It's a very valuable part of your library, and they'll make sequels.
Right. Now, when you're doing that VOD transaction, okay, or you're watching, you know, the Secret Life of Pets on, well, whether it's the Cartoon Network or the Disney Channel. Well, actually, it wouldn't be on the Disney Channel since it's a Universal film.
Yep.
But whatever channel you happen to be watching it on 10 years from now, or, you know, Netflix, you're probably going to be doing it through a set-top box or a smart TV, right?
Not 10 years from now, no. I don't think that's necessary.
Well, I picked a round number.
When it comes out this year, yes, absolutely. And that set-top box you're paying money for, and that's not going to change anytime soon.
No, not at all. Unfortunately, what happened was nothing, actually. We've talked about this in the past. The Federal Communications Commission was trying to make kind of this freedom of set-top boxes, these cable set-top boxes or satellite set-top boxes. They were trying to force these cable providers and pay TV providers to allow any set-top box to be used, like an Apple TV or a Roku or an Amazon Fire.
Or I mean, just to let you buy it.
Yeah, just you know, go out and buy
theirs.
Third-party
companies can create a new one and you can buy it. Right, so basically they have this technology. It's dusty, it's tired. People don't need it, but they're forced to rent it month after month after month for years. They could just buy one for $150 or $200, but instead they pay $200 a year for the luxury of renting a piece of equipment they don't really need. And it's even less necessary now that you have smart TVs and Apples and Rokus in a lot of homes. So people are like, this is wrong. Why are we paying $20 billion a year to these companies just for the pleasure of renting, you know, your remote and your set-top box? So the FCC said, hey, this is wrong. This is a, you know, this has got to end. The technology has moved way past this and you need to stop. And they were poised to pass that ruling and say, we got to free the set-top box. And what happened?
Nothing. They basically pulled the vote.
Well, it seemed one commissioner had some technical concerns. They're saying, no, she's really detail-oriented. She didn't want them to figure it out later. She felt like some of the ruling as far as how the FCC would oversee the agreements between cable companies and content providers was a little wishy-washy, and she wanted that cleared up. So the implication is, we'll come back to this. This will still happen. Don't assume it's dead.
Correct. And basically, the wishy-washy part was, if you make an app and you try to get it on, let's say, you know, a competitor's set-top box, the competitor should not be allowed to block you from putting the app on. Okay.
Right.
And so rather than spell out exactly what the kind of rebuttal process would be or the appeals process would be, they just kind of said, you can't do that. And if that does happen, well, you know, come and talk to us.
They said, behave yourselves.
Right. Exactly. You know, this restraint of trade issue. Or, you know, fair and reasonable licensing fees.
And yet that's exactly what people do all the time. You have your MP3 player and you make it really hard for other people's MP3 music to get on your machine.
Correct.
So, you know, that is a problem. It is an issue. So some say, hey, they're going to figure this out. Maybe the vote will happen. Or is this delay a death sentence given that we're in an election year?
Well, they're trying to punt, basically, is what's happening. And by punt, I mean the studios, the networks, the cable providers, they're all hoping that, you know, a new FCC commissioner will be chosen with after the election. Tom Wheeler won't be there anymore. And the new commissioner won't care about this. Having already seen how difficult it is, we'll just go and, you know, pick some
other. Well, it's not. Is it that difficult? Because they had the votes. It was just one Democratic member of the board who raised the concern about this issue, feeling it was too murky. So is it that difficult? They were ready to do it. Now, we know that I think it was the Hollywood Reporter said, controversial set-top box vote was delayed. And my immediate thought was, it's only controversial if you're a Hollywood studio or a cable company, because it ain't controversial to anyone else, is it?
Correct. Yes.
And all of America thinks this should happen.
And frankly, all of America thinks this probably should have happened already. Certainly, you know, at this point, they're kind of like saying, well, you're legislating buggy whips in the time of the horseless carriage. It's like, who cares at this point?
Because people are still paying $200 a year and $20 billion a year in North America for the luxury of renting set-top boxes. That's why.
Correct. Because otherwise people won't know that they can put their own box in.
But they can't.
Well, right now they can't. Correct. But,
right.
Yeah. So even if they were to open this up and the cable companies were to say, okay, we're just going to do this. It doesn't. No laws needed. We're just going to open it up. Nobody would know. There would be few people that switched. Kind of like when all of a sudden you could own your own phone instead of rent the phone from the phone company. How many people immediately switched, ran out and bought a phone? It took a decade before that, you know, most phones were owned.
You don't think the people with smart TVs and Apple TVs and Rokus would stop renting their set-top box if they didn't need to anymore?
Okay, to your point, I agree with that. I do think that the conversion would be much faster.
Yeah, I do too. And one thing is clear, the FCC wants to show it's still got a little bite. They're also moving forward to look, I mean, even though it's the end of the year practically, they're looking forward at rules that govern contracts that limit access to independent channels. So in certain ways, the contracts between the cable channels and the cable companies, they work together to sort of smother any new competition. So that's why you don't get, you know, public access TV sort of equivalent of small, odd, independent channels popping up on your cable network, because it's only big players with big companies behind them that get channels onto your cable package. And they're saying they want to look at those rules and try and free up voices so that more people can get their channel somehow embedded into the mix so that they can reach a wider audience. I don't know if that'll work, but it seems in line with saying, hey, these boxes are outmoded and outdated and you're making billions of dollars and it's pointless. And to saying, hey, we want cable and the access to television and the airwaves to be broader and you know, better. And we're going to try and do that.
Well, what's interesting about this from an international perspective is, you know, the U.S. market is, you know, 200 million set-top boxes, right? And if you don't have the opportunity to sell into that market, a guaranteed market, which is what it is now, then you're going to make fewer boxes, which means you're going to develop less product, which means the companies that build the boxes for the United States and Canada will build fewer boxes, not only for North America, but all the continents.
There will be more competition, because instead of only being, you know, having to get a deal with Time Warner Cable, you get to make a deal and put your stuff in the store and sell it to anyone. Anyone can buy your set-top box. You're not limited. You can have lots of smaller
companies.
Don't
you think it's just going to come down to like Apple or Google or, you know, the big boys, the big players, the Rokus of the world that are already out there? It'll come down to like a few players. Just like, you know, just because anybody can make a cell phone that works on any one of the providers, it still comes down to Apple and Samsung and HTC and, you know, Xiaomi.
Well, I didn't think you'd come up with a set-top box in your garage, but there will be more competition. Instead of being forced to take Time Warner Cable's box, you can choose which one you want.
Right, correct.
So I think there would be better set-top boxes with more DVR memory and more possibilities embedded into them than we get today. And you can buy it once for $150 or maybe $100 instead of paying $200 a year. Everybody wins except the cable company.
Well, if it comes to fruition, and I think it probably will, as we've discussed, I think, you know, while being a little late, it'll still be worthwhile for the FCC to pursue this.
It's true. I don't care. Set-top box or no set-top box, there's too much television. I can't stay on top of it all.
You're not supposed to stay on top of the television. You're supposed to sit in front of it.
That may be part of the problem. And I have the same problem with books. Too many books coming out. That's why I've now got some people reviewing books for me on Bookfilter. So this week, you know, I'm going to tell you what book to buy, and I haven't even read it myself.
Well, wait a second. Isn't Bookfilter a book lover's best friend?
I think so.
Yeah, that's actually a plug for Michael's website where you can find out, you know, what book to read, because you have like weeks and months of books in advance.
Absolutely.
What
and
is
this
it
week,
this week?
We have a lot of cool books coming out every week. There's interesting stuff. There is The Kid, a Western about Billy the Kid by Ron Hanson, who is the author of one of the great Westerns, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Great book, great movie. There's a biography about Julia Childs, which I did read, which is not as good as her earlier delightful memoir, My Life in France. If you like her or TV cooking at all, you should check her original book, My Life in France, out. Thomas Kennelly of Schindler's List fame, he has a novel about Napoleon that's out. And if you're rooting for sanity in the elections, you might be interested in William F. Buckley Jr.'s book. It's a history of his TV show, The Firing Line, which was a real precursor to all the yelling and screaming you had on TV, but it was actually a sane, sober, intellectually stimulating version of all that. And it's a pretty fascinating look at all that. But the book that I'm naming as the number one pick of the week is, in fact, a mystery. I'm actually dying to read it, and that's why I suggested my critic read it. It's by Gaslight, and the novel is written by Stephen Price. It's a Victorian mystery by the Canadian poet Stephen Price, and it's about William Pinkerton, the son of the famed detective, and he's determined to track down a notorious con artist who outfoxed his dad. And to do so, he's got to join forces with this gentleman, and that man has his own agenda of trying to find his lost love, and you got fog-shrouded London, the battlefields of the Civil War, a lot of good early rave reviews, including one from Janet Rotter, my critic, and so that was really fun to see. You know, it's one of those books you pick out and say, that looks really promising. I liked the cover, I liked the description, I liked some of the early industry reviews. My critic read it, she loved it. So, you know, this looks like it could be a breakout book for the fall.
And if it is a big breakout book, then I guess we could say it would be a big deal then?
Absolutely.
Then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Now, you're going to have to explain this. We're kind of staying in the book world a little bit here. You're going to have to explain this to me, Michael, because the Alana Ferrante quartet of novels set in Italy have become an international sensation, enjoying literary acclaim and huge sales. Now, they're coming to the stage as well. A company in London announced they would be mounting an adaptation of the first book, My Close Friend, and they're going to be doing that in February of 2017. Now, here's the part where you may have some explaining to do, at least for me. Since Ferrante has possibly been outed by an investigative journalist, maybe she'll even attend opening night. Have no idea what that means, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's just the latest step in the conquering of this series. It's been a huge hit all over the world. It is being turned into a TV miniseries. That's happening, and now it's coming to the stage as well. That's very clear. But there also were news stories this week. There was a journalist who tracked down and figured out, based on royalty checks, who the real Alana Ferrante is. She's been anonymous. She's used a nom de plume to maintain her privacy.
What is it with you and the French today?
I don't know what's happening. And so this guy figured out who she was, and he said, this is Alana Ferrante. The person involved hasn't confirmed it yet. But what's sort of interesting is, you know, there was all this buzz and speculation about who it might be. And once this guy kind of fairly definitively seemed to figure out who it was, the reaction from a lot of people was, leave her alone. I don't want to know.
Right.
It's nice to have a little mystery in the world this day. It's nice. If she wants to be private, who cares? Is that so important that you should go digging into garbage cans to figure out who the author of this book is? But I guess that's fame in this age. Privacy is a myth.
Well, first, Zayn Malik said he just couldn't handle all the touring and attention. Then he launched a solo album, a memoir heavy with photos, and is helping develop a TV drama about boy bands for NBC. Of course, Zayn Malik is with One Direction, or was with One Direction. Now, One Direction member Niall Horan, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I think it's just Neil.
Neil Horan?
Okay. I think so, but I don't know.
I should tell you, I'm not up on my boy bands. And I know One Direction is like beyond popular. Well, Neil, who is so much cuter, by the way, than Harry Styles. I mean, seriously, folks. Well, Horan has signed a solo deal with Capitol Records and launched his first single. Sure, the band is on an 18-month quote-unquote hiatus, but still, it feels like the end. Isn't NSYNC on a hiatus, too? Thank God the Monkees have a new album out. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. They are on a hiatus. He does have a single out. That's the point of the hiatus, to let them pursue solo projects and movies and stuff. But I do love it when you read stuff that you haven't pre-read. That's always enjoyable. You're like, oh, what am I saying here? So, you know, it feels like, yeah, this is it. You know, maybe I'm sure they'll reunite and come together again someday. Maybe even Zayn will join them again in 10 or 15 years. But yeah, it feels like, come on, this is the band has exploded into a million parts. So that's too bad. But by the way, I mentioned the Monkees because their new album is really, really good.
I know. It's remarkable. And not all of them are around anymore.
No, just one. Yeah, just one died.
Yeah, Davy Jones.
Oh, was it Davy Jones?
Okay, actually, now I take that back, of course.
It was Michael Nesmith, wasn't it?
No, I think Michael Nesmith is still alive. Is Michael Nesmith alive? We're finding out live here on Showbiz Sandbox.
Wow, we've really not done our homework this week.
No, and I don't even know where.
Michael Nesmith is alive.
Yes.
But Davy Jones,
sadly, is not.
Dead.
Yes.
Sorry about that guy.
Next week on...
one is Canadian?
Exactly. I don't know how that One Direction story snuck in there. I for some reason I didn't see that when I was prepping, but I did see this next story actually about the big debate that everybody's talking about?
We're recording on a Tuesday, and tonight will be the debate between the vice presidents. So we're actually talking about the debate that took place last week, aren't we?
Yes. Now, I thought it was the vice presidential debate is on Thursday.
It's on tonight.
Okay. See, I don't even know anymore. However, the first presidential debate, some 86 million people watched Hillary Clinton take Donald Trump to the cleaners in the first presidential debate. Network execs are now wondering if Trump can always run for office, any office. It doesn't matter, senator, congressman, just as long as he's running, saying goofy stuff, they will get ratings. Now, that 84 million viewers includes all the various channels that broadcast the debate, but not the people who streamed it via Twitter and other online sites. By any measure, it beat the first Ronald Reagan-Jimmy Carter debate in 1980, although that debate drew a larger percentage of the population, so it was still the bigger draw by the fairest measure. Total numbers might hit 90 million viewers or people or more. I mean, that's absolutely astounding to me. Now viewers can look forward to round two on Sunday, October 9th, with Martha Raddatz and Anderson Cooper moderating Big Deal or Big Whoop.
It's a big deal, right? We knew it would be a big draw, but who knows how many people actually watched it. I mean, I time delayed it. You can replay it on YouTube. You know, the ways to access this stuff now is remarkable. And the bigger the original number, I assume just like live sports in the Olympics, everybody wanted to watch it live. But I figure you got to get a couple more million people in there. So I think 90 million is a pretty safe bet.
Yeah, think about it. It's close to Super Bowl numbers.
Yeah, but 80 million people watch the Reagan-Carter debates. So, you know, the presidential debates draw a big audience, especially when it's a strongly contested year.
Well, right. And if you recall, that was the year there were, you know, Iranian hostages, the oil crisis. I mean, there was a lot going on in 1980.
There always is.
Yes. Now, Amazon has always tried to clamp down on fake or paid reviews on its website. But up until now, it has allowed incentivized reviews. And those are reviews where the person doing the review, the reviewer, gets a free or discounted copy of a product, makes clear they did so, and then posts a review. You see this a lot with books. Well, the gravy train is over because Amazon changed its guidelines and says those are now verboten. Those types of reviews, can't do them. They will still continue the Vine program, in which Amazon itself, not the seller, chooses who is a trusted reviewer and makes certain items available, like books and DVDs. And they do that to boost attention for products that haven't been widely reviewed or released yet. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. You know, Amazon is the number one, you know, market in the country, and their reviews are hugely influential. I walk into a store to buy something like a product. I was going to buy a
TV.
I was buying a NutriBullet or something else, and I thought, well, which one? You know, I go there to look. How many reviews does it have? What do they say? What are the problems and complaints? You know, that really influences how I do it. I look to see how many, what nature, what quality. So, you know, once you've got a lot of reviews up there, that really makes a difference. And you get a lot of reviews by first seeding a few reviews. You know, if you see no reviews, you're less likely to look at it or buy it. Once there's a few, then you see it. And so they seed it with reviews, and then more people join in, and then suddenly it snowballs. So I think it really makes a big difference. And I think it's a good change. I think it had gotten out of control. And what they're doing is they're saying, look, readers don't trust those reviews anymore because there's too many of these and they feel like, it's all fake. And so they're trying to clamp down on all the different ways that these customer reviews are being cheapened. And yeah, this is the big way that remains. You know, it's always hard to end the fake or paid reviews, but this is another way that they're sort of cheapened and they're saying it's got to stop.
Well, you know, you almost never ever saw them for DVDs or movies. You sometimes see them for music, right? But you almost always see them for books.
Well, a lot of that though is their Vine program, but you see them for products. You know, I see it when I'm looking at just regular products in the kitchen and elsewhere. You know, people just send them stuff. You know, once you review enough things, then you get on the list of marketers and they say, hey, we'll send you stuff. But I'll tell you, this was shocking. There was a CNBC article talking about what percentage of U.S. households were Amazon Prime members. Do you have a guess?
I would say percentage of U.S. households, I'm going to go with 40%.
Wow, that is so high. You're lying. You saw it already. Because, I mean, I would have probably said 1 in 5. That would seem a lot to me.
Everybody I know has this Prime at this point.
Which my friend would say, everybody you know is a wealthy white person in California, Beverly Hills. So that doesn't count.
I wish.
You can't extrapolate your personal taste into... Yes,
and I wish, you know, by the way, the Beverly Hills part, everything else, you know.
Every movie star lives around the corner from you. Every time we mention someone, you're like, oh, yeah, they live up the block.
Yeah, yeah. And by up the block, I mean, literally, I'm in like the valley and they have a nice view.
So you're truly not shocked that almost half of all U.S. households pay a premium price just to get free shipping.
Based on the
that
way,
is huge.
Based on the way that malls and department stores are suffering, yes, I would not be surprised. So what's the number? What's the number? Now you got me.
44%. 44% of all U.S. households were Amazon Prime members. That's 49 million households.
Oh, my God. Wait a second. It says right here, CNBC article saying 44%. You know what? I didn't read that one either.
Oh, that's very funny.
Okay.
Yes, 44. It's getting close to 50% of all households in America. And you think about the 10 or 15% of households, you know, there's tens of millions of kids in poverty. You know, there's people... There's, you know, tens of millions of households that are poor.
Yes. And by the way, Alaska and Hawaii, they don't have...
Well, they're pretty small populations,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I was shocked, I have to say. When you think about that they're bigger than Walmart, it's less shocking. But, I mean, I would have said, wow, 20%, and I would have thought that was huge.
Rolling Stone magazine has been trying to figure out how to survive the digital future. What with declining subscriptions and an aging reader base composed of mostly middle-aged men like Michael.
Hey!
Well, you know, I'm just saying. In response, Rolling Stone has adapted its website, churning out daily newsletters linked to tons of stories and videos, made most of its feature stories in the magazine available online even before the magazine has been printed, and generally reached tens of millions of web surfers around the world. Now they're doubling down on digital, selling off a minority stake in Rolling Stone magazine itself. Not the entire Jan Werner empire, just, you know, the magazine. To a Singapore company called BandLab, they are partnering with to turn Rolling Stone into a global digital brand that can turn its name and all those eyeballs into money. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, except for the size of the... I mean, they bought 49% of the magazine. I'm not sure why they felt the need to not just partner with them, why they felt the need to sell off so much of a big chunk of it. They have a dozen international editions. They have 22 million monthly visitors here in the U.S. to their website. They have tens of millions or more following them on social media. And obviously, they want to say, hey, we want to be the world leader in video content and branding for concerts and stuff like that. And they think BandLab is going to help them do it.
Well, you know, we talked about all of those billion-dollar movies that Disney made this year. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we just throw this one to the wolves as well. What do you think? This okay. next story. Because Disney is prepping a live-action remake of its iconic animated movie, The Lion King. And so by wolves, I mean lions. And by live-action, we mean an animated digital computer-generated imagery intended to look live-action. Think The Jungle Book, but with a lot more singing. Since The Lion King is essentially devoid of humans, the necessity for a live-action version is, I don't know, I guess the word I'd use is unclear, I guess, until you remember that the stage musical is the most valuable single entertainment property in the world, without even counting the movie's grosses. This follows in the steps of too many reboots and remakes to count, including Scarface at the Movies, Dynasty on the CW, The Gong Show, which is a game show on ABC, the toy cars, Hot Wheels, they're going to become a movie, and so on and so forth. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? They're just going to remake every damn property they have. If it's live action, they'll make it animated. If it's animated, they'll make it live action. But truly, you know, this week, I think there was such an overload of you know, MacGyver and other stuff opening on network TV and 10 million new projects, every single one of which feels like a remake or a reboot or a rehash of something that came earlier. It's getting exhausting.
Well, you know, the problem is that when you do have something original, it gets shot down. Just ask NBC, because right now NBC is enjoying good reviews and modest but positive ratings for the sitcom Superstore, so they jumped on the creator's new idea, a sitcom called Mail Order Bride. You know, what could go wrong? It's about a widower who orders a bride from the Philippines to help raise his two young daughters. I wish I could do that. The mere plot description created a frenzy of internet activity, with people decrying the cultural stereotypes, the reinforcement of colonialism via the U.S. military, and not to mention the human trafficking angle. NBC said, okay, never mind that pitch. Somewhere, an American-Filipino actress just saw a leading role opportunity fly out the window. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, but it's a little bizarre, isn't it? I mean, it's based on one of the creator's life, you know, his mom.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like, well, golly, perhaps they might have done it sensitively. Maybe you'd want to come up with a new name. Maybe she doesn't have to literally be a mail order bride. But, you know, It just seemed like an insane overreaction on every level to a one-line plot description.
Right. I completely agree. And when they were like, we're dumping this thing before it even airs, I'm like, you know what you're doing? You're dumping it before the first script is written, actually.
Yeah. Maybe it would have been a thoughtful, intelligent, funny, modern, nuanced, take on Clash of Cultures. You know, Superstore's a well-reviewed show.
Yeah, fresh off the boat. Look at Fresh Off the Boat.
Yeah, exactly. You could have a one-line description of that. That seems offensive.
Yes.
If Mail Order Bride is offensive, they can change the title.
Exactly. So apparently, by the way, Michael, you're not supposed to rip music from YouTube to create your own free music files, just
what?
So you know. Yeah. The website YouTube MP3 did exactly that, proving so easy to use that even your friend's mom and Uncle Bob could figure out how to do it. It garners some 60 million active users a month, since seemingly every song imaginable is on YouTube. That's proven a problem, and a coalition of record labels and industry organizations from around the world are suing with both guns blazing. They say YouTube MP3 is currently a bigger problem than pirate websites. Mm-hmm. They want it to stop, and they want their money back. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
I agree.
Because it's whack-a-mole. They got to do it, of course. But I'll tell you, I knew this was a problem when my brother's ex-wife said she was getting all her music that way. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Because this is not a tech-savvy person. That's just a person in their 40s or 50s. You know, it's just, wow. If they're doing it, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know. I mean, I guess that just speaks volumes as to who might actually still care to own music. Is somebody in their 50s? Whereas,
that's
like,
true. Well, they're not owning it. They're just stealing it.
Well, but you understand what I mean.
It's wanting to take a file and have it on their phone and put it in their car and do whatever with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody else is like, what? Who cares whether you own, just
that's what they said at the Apple store when I brought in my phone and my laptop. I was like, yeah, I've got all this music. And he's like, oh, okay. I'm like, yeah, you don't own any music, do you? You just subscribe to Apple Music or Spotify. He goes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I go, that's because you're under 40.
Exactly.
I go, and you have a tattoo, right? He goes, yeah, actually I do. I go, yeah. He said, that's creepy. I go, yeah. And I said, you probably don't post on Instagram anymore. He goes, no, I do. I go, yeah, but not as much as you used to. And he went, yeah, that's true.
He said,
stop reading my mind.
Listen, I'd love to continue this conversation, but I have to post something on Snapchat. A new survey tracked 220 million people and more than 3.5 billion video analytic events per day, okay? The result? It seems mobile viewing makes up 51% of all online video watching. That's all online video watching.
A majority of it occurs on mobile.
Worldwide, a more than 200% increase from 2014 and up 15% from 1 year ago. In other words, the growth is still huge, but definitely slowing down. Phones make up 43% of all video views, up to 10% from 1 year ago, and tablets make up another 8%, a substantial 51% increase from 2015. So tablets are the fastest growing category, even though in North America, they seem more abundant. That was a lot of numbers. Big deal or big whoop?
To put this into perspective, 43% of all mobile viewing is done on a phone and 8% is done on tablets. So tablets are still holding their own. But frankly, I'm surprised it's not a little higher. Because
yeah,
I think a lot of people don't have TVs, right? You're looking at India, you're looking at Africa. There's great economic strides in those countries. But you would think that there'd be a lot of people in areas where their phone is their life. And
yeah,
I think all their viewing would come on the phone.
Yeah, so but connectivity is the issue there. That's the issue. So you have data caps and connectivity being the issue.
Sure. But if they're going to watch any video, it's not on their high-def screen.
Right,
it's
but they're
on
not.
Their phone.
But they're not watching a lot of it. So in the developed countries are accounting for probably a majority.
Oh, I see. They're watching 100,000 hours,
right,
as opposed to 10 hours.
Right.
I see.
Now let me ask you: did you watch Westworld? Because
yes, I did.
The robots are rising, and they really, really hate flies. Okay, that's the takeaway from the launch of HBO's new drama Westworld. Given the channel's struggles in launching a new drama in the past few years, a lot of attention has been paid to this $100 million gamble on a little-known, little-loved sci-fi movie in the 1970s. The debut episode garnered as many viewers as the premiere episode of True Detective, Season 1, at least according to HBO, pointing to an almost identical 3.3 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
They're like, it's just like season one of True Detective. Please forget about season two of True Detective.
Right, exactly.
It's their best drama launch in a while. I think it's a big whoop. There was so much press and attention for it. I think it's understandable that it had a decent, solid sampling rate. But having seen it, I don't think they're going to stick around.
Oh.
However, what I think is interesting here is that HBO told us what the overnights were. They didn't wait. They're like, no, we will not discuss overnights. We won't discuss. We're not going to, spoil the pooch. We're not gonna screw the pooch. That sounds rude too. What is the phrase?
I don't know. Well, maybe leave dogs out of it.
Leave the dogs out of it. We're not gonna mess things up by telling you the overnight numbers. That's silly. And here they did because they had such good news to share. It's just like when they got great news, they're gonna tell you what the 3D breakdown is. They're gonna tell you what the overnights are. Hopefully in a few days they'll get add on 4 or 5, a couple million more people. So we'll have to see where the actual numbers of people who watch the show. We'll find out in a week or two. But HBO couldn't hold themselves back. They were so happy and relieved that it had a decent, solid opening, and that's exactly what it is. I don't think they're going to stick around because I know I won't.
Oh, well, I haven't seen the first episode yet. I do have it videotaped. No, listen to me. Like, how old am I?
DVR?
DVR,
yeah. Any of it on demand, too, right?
Yes, I could do it on demand. Actually, I can do it on demand because I have a smart TV. In any case, it's every startup's dream to create a website that proves so popular you build a genuine business, employ lots of people, and then, no, just kidding. The real dream is to get bought out, because who knows when something new will come along and make you obsolete. Well, the dream is happening for SoundCloud, which became a great artist to fan resource. I love this website, garnering some 175 million active monthly users and a library of 125 million tracks. SoundCloud recently tried to launch a streaming service to slightly less success than Apple, as in, none at all. Luckily, Spotify wants to buy it anyway, which is interesting since SoundCloud cut deals with the major record labels that are contrary to Spotify's DNA, like allowing labels to restrict tracks to paid users only and so on. The deal isn't official yet, but talks are advanced. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know. It's a big deal. I guess if they make SoundCloud go away, what's their point? Do they want to get access to those tracks? They clearly don't care about their streaming service, and they certainly aren't going to want to make the same deal that SoundCloud had for the streaming service element of its website.
No, I think really SoundCloud, it started out as a way to, house audio files and house, it was like basically an audio streaming platform. So if you were a musician, you could put your music there for professional purposes and then send it out to people who could then stream it, on the down low, so to speak. You didn't have to broadcast it out. But then, as you say, Michael, it became a great fan resource. The artist could reach out directly to fans and say, here's my new track. You could or could not download it. You could actually, set it so that people can just stream it, but they can't download it. You could take the track back when you wanted to put it on a CD or something. That said, it's become very popular. There's been some talk about how SoundCloud, is in a bit of money trouble here, and they may need an infusion of cash. And as you say, Michael, they did not do very well with their kind of premium service.
Right. They've been trying to sort of make themselves over into YouTube, where, okay, we've got all these tracks here. People are listening to them. We want to have ads nearby so that people can monetize all this listening going on, right?
Right. And I actually know they just opened a West Coast Los Angeles office, and I know a number of people who went to work for them who are all like, great, we just started and now we're being bought by Spotify. That's just perfect. But they were there to sell ads and still are there to sell ads for this service. What I would say Spotify's interest is, everybody, if you're a musician, Bandcamp, SoundCloud, because that's where you put your music to go directly to fans. That's just where you go. So
if they wanted to buy it, they should keep it what it is.
They should keep it what it is and maybe use it as an ingress into the Spotify platform for musicians. That's really what I would, recommend.
Yeah, and the one reason it works is because there's no intermediary. If you want to post stuff on it, you can.
Right,
you don't have to get it approved or passed over by somebody. You put it up on SoundCloud and it's there.
Exactly.
Just like YouTube.
And then you rip it using MP3, YouTube, whatever that is.
No!
I'm kidding. But I'm not kidding about the fact that we are done with Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and we're moving along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, we're going to kind of do a drive-by on this one because we've talked about it a lot over the past several months. And of course, we're talking about Viacom, we're talking about CBS, we're talking about National Amusements, we're talking about the Redstone family. Sumner Redstone and Sherry Redstone, his daughter, have now gone to CBS and to Viacom and said, hey, you know what? We own 80% of both of you. So here's what we're thinking of doing. Why don't we put you guys together?
Right. It seems to be like the marriage of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. You know, they got married, they got divorced, and then everybody loved them so much, so glamorous, their troubled marriage, but they wanted them to get back together. It didn't seem like a good idea. Nobody thought they should do it, but it's going to happen anyway.
That's right. Because when you own 80% of both companies, you basically say, well, let's turn it over to the shareholders and they can, oh yes, we decided, yes, that's what we're going to do. Now, why would you do this? Because in 2005, the, you know, Sumner Redstone said, all right, I own CBS, I own Viacom, they're all in one big company. I'm going to kind of
unlock the growth and unlock the value.
Right.
By breaking them up.
CBS can focus on what it focuses on and do just what it does. And then we can have Viacom, which seemed at the time like, oh man, this is the growth company because, you know, all those retransmission fees that you're going to get from all those 26 channels that Viacom owns and the Paramount Pictures and everything, that's the real growth company. CBS is a nice company, a good company. They're going to be a nice little dividend and they're going to earn stuff, you know, kind of on a predictable basis. It's not going to grow very much, but it's still a good investment. Well, it turns out, actually, funny thing happened on the way to the forum. Looks like CBS has since that time gone up 160% its value, you know, its stock
value.
So
it worked. So the decision to break them up worked.
Well, it worked.
They unlocked potential of CBS that perhaps would not have been there.
Correct. Yes, very much so. However, now they're the ones with all the cash. You know who doesn't have a lot of cash right now and whose stock is actually exactly where it was? So it skyrocketed or went up and now is right back down to where it was at the split during 2005-2006 is Viacom. They are in cash trouble. Okay, their movies have not been doing well over at Paramount Pictures. They have about $1 billion worth of debt that has to be refinanced within the next 6 months, you know, give or take, or they have to pay it off. And so that was why Philip DeMann, who is no longer the head of Viacom, was looking to sell a big stake of Paramount Pictures because
wanted to raise money.
Yeah, he was basically looking ahead and going, you know, what we really need to pay off this debt is money. Actually, and one way to refinance is to say, look, okay, we owe $1 billion. Look, here, take $200-300 million, okay, and we will either pay it off entirely with the money that we get from the sale, or $200-300 million, and we'll refinance the rest. So,
right. In other words, they've got a big mess at Viacom, and they want Les Moonves and CBS to come clean it up.
Well, that's one scenario. So there's really two scenarios, and Michael Wolff does a good job of laying this out. One scenario is Viacom goes it alone. They basically say, no, we're keeping the company separate. Viacom will be Viacom, CBS will be CBS. If that's the case, who runs Viacom? You got rid of Philip DeMann. Tom Dooley, who took over in the interim, said, yeah, I'm out. The one thinking is maybe Tom Freston, who used to head Viacom, will come back. There's some bad blood there between the Redstones and Tom Freston, so that would be an interesting play.
What other straight white men are available?
Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Oh, okay, great.
He's available. Peter Chernin, who, you know, as the producer of Miss Peregrine, okay, this week's top movie, so I don't know. But he used to run Fox. He used to be the head of Fox. And so some thinking is, well, you're kind of you're available if you want to come on over and run Viacom. You could do that. And then, of course, recently free, Jim Giannopoulos, who used to also head Fox, but, you know, Stacey Snyder came in and said, you know, can you hold on to this letter opener for me? Oh, it's not a letter opener. Apparently it's a knife. And kind of offed Jim Giannopoulos. And so he's kind of available.
But these fantasies of who might come in and run Viacom if it stays separate don't take into account the fact that the majority shareholders of each company want them to merge.
Well, they want them to merge because it's the easiest way to get...
Right, but if that's what they want, that's going to happen.
That is correct.
That's the whole point of this article.
That's
right. Nice. Michael Wolff, I think that boat has sailed, right?
Yes, and even he's saying, you know, the reality is Les Moonves may be the new head of Viacom whether he wants to be or not.
Right. He's going to have a good buyout package.
Yes, because, I mean, basically, it's you're basically putting somebody on a boat that's already sinking and saying, by the way, can you turn this boat around and get it back to shore safely? Because
so this is gonna happen. And what does it mean for Paramount? What does it mean for all the people who are in the industry dealing with Viacom? They want some stability. They want someone in charge. They want a sense that Viacom is turning itself around, and they want to get new energized excitement at Paramount, right?
That's correct. Everything you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean for our listeners? Well, in the short term, you're not going to be getting a lot of fresh new content out of Viacom, and probably not that much out of Paramount Pictures either. In the long run, what it could mean is that Les Moonves and his management team has to take their eye off the ball at CBS, and thus you could make that company a little bit weaker.
So then maybe that means we won't get NCIS Oklahoma.
Ooh, that's
you
a
know,
good one.
Whatever new spinoff is coming along.
I'm writing that one down.
Which brings us into the obituaries, doesn't it? Two people died this week, one very unexpectedly. The other was 93, so not unexpectedly. The first is NCIS showrunner Gary Glassberg. He died at 50, so obviously that was out of nowhere. I think he died in his sleep. Very sad. He also helped launch NCIS New Orleans successfully. He worked on Crossing Jordan and Bones. He joined NCIS in the middle of its run in 2009 and became the executive producer in 2010. It's the most watched network show on television. You know, maybe Game of Thrones is bigger around the world, but this is a big, big show, and it has a lot of spinoff shows as well. So that's a real shock. But these shows are, you know, you think, how much does this throw a show like that off its game? Because it's a wrenching change for a show, but it's not a show that's driven by one singular creative vision. As important as Gary is, who joined the show in the middle of its run, I think a show like NCIS, unlike, say, if, you know, a
Mad
show
Men
powered by one person.
Yeah.
Writing scripts and doing all that, it seems like a very different beast. It's a shocking personal loss. I'm sure he did a great job running the show, obviously, but the NCIS is not going to flounder after this, despite the personal loss and pain that they're all going to feel.
No, I mean, if Sam Eshmel or, you know, walked away from Mr. Robot, you'd have a problem. If you know, Matthew Weiner had walked away from Mad Men, you would have had a problem.
Though the show would have gone on.
Yes, correct.
Because they want to make money. On the opposite end of the scale is Agnes Nixon, a legend in daytime soap opera. She died at 93, so it's not a shock to anyone, and she had a great long life. She was the creator of All My Children and One Life to Live, among others. I mean, she literally began in radio, writing for Woman in White, and she innovated a big time by weaving real-life issues into soap operas. She had racial and ethnic diversity back in the 60s. Take that, you know, Black Lives Matter for primetime. You people need to get your game going. She's been doing it for, you know, 50 years now. One of her great things she did was she had a black character introduced on a show who was passing as white and didn't tell anybody. So you had a character on the show that was white, and people knew her, saw her, fell in love with her, and then like 6 months into her character storyline, the show revealed that this character was a black person passing as white. And that's in the late 60s, early 70s, when people go, oh, wow. You know, I liked this. That was a really big, ballsy move to do back in the day. That's very cool. So she's just a really fascinating, important character. She was there at the beginning of daytime soaps, and obviously she went there right through to the end, pretty much.
Now, and I know I don't have this one in the show notes, Michael, so I'll have to put it in, but I would like to mention the passing of Gordon Davidson, who died at 83. He mm-hmm. is the, or was, the head of the Mark Taper Forum and the Center Theater Group here in Los Angeles. Much like Lincoln Center is in New York, the Center Theater Group is to Los Angeles, and he really was instrumental not only in theater here in Los Angeles, but really the world. I mean, this is a guy that launched and produced and directed shows like Children of a Lesser God, which went on to Broadway and then became a movie, and Angels in America is another one that you might know. It all started here at the Mark Taper Forum, and is really, I guess he's really seen as kind of a great cultural figure here in Los Angeles and in the theater world around the world. And if you can, I'll place a link to his obituary in the show notes. It's worth a read.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was Angels in America, started there in a workshop in 1990.
Yes, that's right. And that was before, well, it's kind of, you know, a lot of people were ignoring the AIDS crisis, and that play took it on head on.
Nah, I think that's a little post that. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's I don't think that was the particularly notable thing as such. You know, there were a number of significant gay plays before that that dealt with AIDS. It just was a sprawling, epic, great work.
Yes, it certainly was. And you had to see it, like, what, over two nights, I believe? Two or three nights?
Well, it was two parts. It was part one, and then, you know, months later on Broadway came part two.
Right.
So, you know, just, yeah, there were two separate three-hour plays.
Right. Well, we also have some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, the letter we have today, it was an email from James Gardner from Cinetech Geek and Digital out of Melbourne, Australia. And really what he's talking about is an audio company, an audio equipment manufacturer, professional audio equipment, that is, QSC. They acquired another professional audio equipment company called Ultra Stereo Labs, or USL. And these are, you know, they make equipment not only for motion picture technology and motion picture industries, but also for, you know, audio industries. That happened yesterday, as a matter of fact. That's how recent this is. And he writes, I know this is very inside baseball. Actually, that was the last segment. But this is an end of an era in cinema exhibition technology. Out of the best companies from the film era, I can clearly remember removing, and when we were upgrading to digital, a lot of Dolby, USL, and DTS sound equipment. They were replaced with digital cinema equipment from USL or Dolby units, and DTS was gone by then. Dolby are really the last ones standing, and they had to purchase the leader, Do-Re-Mi, to stay relevant until Dolby Atmos took off. He then says, Sperling, I know you have predicted an amalgamation of companies in this area, Dolby, Do-Re-Mi, and now USL and QSC. I would appreciate a quick overview on how it is looking from the homeland, LA. I would also like to wish our friends who work at these companies best of luck, as some redundancies are likely. And these people have been likely working as long as can be remembered in those companies. Now, okay, so Ultra Stereo Labs, they made equipment that helped sound, basically. Mm-hmm. You'd plug your projector into Ultra Stereo cinema audio processors. The audio could be routed to the different amplifiers and speakers, etc. QSC does the same thing.
So this is equipment that you go to a movie theater, you're going to find it up in the booth.
Correct. All booth equipment. Now, QSC makes some stuff that you might buy at home, you know, if you have a high-end home theater, or you might see at a concert, frankly, because it's all really professional-grade equipment.
Okay.
What happened here is that QSC is saying, hey, Ultra Stereo, you have some stuff that we don't. We have some overlap as well. Why don't we just buy you? Ultra Stereo Labs, USL, is saying, hey, we've been in business for umpteen, you know, for decades. I mean, Jack Cashin, who owns USL or did own USL, I don't know how old the company is, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's 50 or 60 years old. And, you know, the people there have been there for eons. There are people like Harold Hallicannon who not only contribute, you know, the knowledge to USL, but knowledge to the industry about how certain technology works, specifically when it comes to audio and subtitles and captioning. So really, QSC is expanding its product portfolio. That's really what this is looked at. I also think it's a way for Jack Cashin, who may be near retirement age, to say, okay, I'm going to take the buyout.
Or put it in hands of somebody who can oversee it for the future. Is that a nicer way of putting it?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's almost the understood. Yeah, he's definitely putting his company in the hands of somebody who he knows can actually do really well with it. QSC is a good company.
But every time we talk about, you know, CBS and Viacom possibly merging back, people in the back room are going to lose their jobs. Every time there's a merger or something like that, people do lose their jobs. It's nice of James to remind us of that.
Yeah, I don't know that that many people at USL or even QSC will lose their jobs, because USL doesn't have that many people working for them. So, yes, there might be one or two people, and that's bad enough. But, you know, it's not going to be the thousands upon thousands that you hear of when, you know, multinational companies merge.
All right.
But
so do you think this is just is this a bad thing? Less competition? Is it good? Is it just normal business? Is it going to help anybody or hurt anybody else?
Well, it's certainly going to help QSC. And, you know, is it good? It's neither good nor bad. It's kind of expected. USL is a company that, you know, for years was the small player, the David to everybody else's Goliath, and did a great job at providing competition to all of the Goliaths out there in the motion picture audio space.
And they did it for decades.
And they did it for decades. Absolutely.
So an end to a great run.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And I think QSC will now take up that mantle as a little bit of a bigger David.
And so now we have to end the era of this episode, don't we?
Wow, that is one way to get us to our outro. Yes, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to the show, download the show, rate and review the show, and please do. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find, usually when our website is not so sick, links to, you know, those ways to subscribe to the show or ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up and you can like us there. All of that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
FreeTheSetTopBox.com.
I think that was your website a few weeks ago, but
we got a new campaign going. Free the Set Top Box. We got a hip hop video with Drake and Frank Ocean singing on it. It's very exciting. A lot of things to try to bring attention to our campaign.
I didn't know that those two particular hip hop artists actually cared about Set Top Boxes so much, but
absolutely. Of course they do.
Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on freethesettopbox.com, which I'm sure is a domain already, is, you know, head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can read all of his work on michaelgiltz.com. And of course, you always have to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. For the week of October 2nd, 2016.
Oh my God, did you watch the debates?
Yes, I did.
Wasn't it annoying when Trump kept interrupting Hillary? That was so annoying. I'm sorry, keep going.
For the week of October 2nd, 2016.
I mean, seriously, when I saw that, I was like, wow, that is annoying when people interrupt other people. People really should pay attention to that and make sure they don't do that because it's rude.